Hello, everyone. I'm your host, Andrea Weckerly, and welcome to the Ready Living Podcast, where each episode is designed to educate, inspire, and empower you to create the life you want. Thanks for joining us, and remember to subscribe for free on your favorite platform. My guest today is Ashley R. Dobbs. She's the director of the University of Richmond's Intellectual Property and Transactional Law Clinic and professor of law practice. She also serves as the faculty advisor for Student Animal Law Society, among other student organizations. She speaks, writes, and advises on animal-related matters, such as providing for pets through estate planning, and lectures on pet trusts for law school classes, financial planning workshops, and pet service businesses. Her past work includes drafting proposed federal legislation related to tax incentives and pet trusts with the Humane Society of the United States. She's also worked with estate planning attorneys in private practice to develop pet trusts for their clients. Ashley has provided legal counsel to organizations such as the Jane Goodall Institute, the Animal Welfare Institute, the Humane Society of the United States, the Doris Day Animal Foundation, and local and national animal welfare organizations. She was a curriculum advisor to the American Prosecutors Association's and Animal Welfare Institute's Animal Cruelty Prosecution Program and chaired the Educational Subcommittee for the American Bar Association's Animal Law Committee. She has served on the boards of numerous animal welfare organizations and from 2012 to 2022 was a director on the board of PetSmart Charities, Inc., one of the largest direct animal welfare grantors in North America. Welcome, Ashley.
Thank you. It's good to be here.
I want to start with an interesting statistic I came across from the American Pet Products Association, namely that 82 million U.S. households own a pet, and that's a lot of people who bring an animal into their home and love and take care of them. Broken down by generation, that's 16% of Gen Z, 32% of millennials, 27% of Generation X, 24% of baby boomers, and 1% of the silent generation. A Pew Research Center report from 2023 found that nearly all U.S. pet owners, 97%, say their pets are part of their family, and that 51% not only consider their pets to be a part of their family, but say they are as much a part of their family as a human member. Yet, what few people know is that in general, companion animals are considered property under American law, in other words, legal things rather than legal persons. Why does this matter in particular when it comes to ensuring the animals are taken care of if something happens to the humans, like incapacity or death?
Yeah, that's a great question. So pets are actually part of the family for nearly all people. But like, as you said, U.S. law treats pets as personal property. They're no different from your laptop or a chair. For example, in Virginia, where I'm sitting, the statute, the laws on the books specifically provide that dogs and cats are personal property and you determine their worth by their fair market value. And the courts will have recognized that pets are something more than a chair, but they still won't allow for any damages other than the fair market value of the animal. So for example, let's say you had a vet malpractice suit, or you were in a car accident and your pet was injured. If you tried to go to court to recover damages to make you whole for that, the court would look at what is your pet worth? What did you pay for them? How is the value diminished? And then that's what you get. So there have been some specific instances with like egregious circumstances where they've said that the person was damaged by somebody intentionally harming the pet in front of them. And so the person got damages in excess of the value of the animal, but it wasn't because for the animal, it was for the person's emotional distress. So what that means for if a family wants to, or if a person wants to take care of their whole family, their human and their non-human family after their death, they can't leave anything to the pet because you can't leave money to a chair. You can't leave money to a dog, right? You can't leave a house to your cat. And so that means if you want to make sure that your non-human family members are taken care of after your death, you have to take special steps that are different from what you do with the regular estate planning for humans.
So let's say somebody's interested in doing that and they contact a friend of the family or a family member, and that family member or friend verbally agrees to take the animal if something happens to their person. Is that going to be enough?
Sadly, most of the time, no. And not because of any ill will on anybody's part necessarily. You know, for example, it may be that that family member agreed at a time in their life when it made sense for them to take on your pets, but then something changed in the interim. bathroom, they have a new baby, a new job, or they lost their job, or they're divorced. And so they're not in the same place they were when they made that promise. Or maybe something changed with your pet and all of a sudden it's really expensive to take care of your pet because of medical bills or something, and they don't have that money. You know, other times it is maybe just ill intent or ignorance. Sometimes people just tell people what they want to hear and say, yes, I will keep your dog after you're gone. And then they turn around and promptly take it to the shelter. I was looking at some of the statistics. The good news is this is lower than it used to be, but you know, about 1 million shelter animals are euthanized each year. That's declined. That's half of what it was 15 years ago, which is great. But the majority of those are relinquished by families. They take the pet there. So while we want to believe that our families or friends are going to do exactly what they said they were going to do, there may be things that keep them from doing it or not taking care of our pet in the way that we would want it to be taken care of.
So it sounds like the safest way of ensuring a person's animals are taken care of if something happens to their human is through estate planning, specifically an animal trust.
I'm not an estate planning attorney, so I'm going to have the broad strokes of it, but I do work with estate planning attorneys about how to work pet trusts into their larger plan. So an estate planning is essentially a collection of documents that outline how you want your assets and your personal property to be handled after you die or become incapacitated. So you could have a will that says, you know, I leave my jewelry to my cousin May. It could be a trust where if you had minor children, you would put money in trust that they get paid a certain amount of years so that they don't burn through it before they're mature. And so they've got money to live on after you're gone. It could include a healthcare directive. There are other kinds of documents in that. Estate planning helps you direct what happens to your stuff and who it goes to and who you take care of, but it also can help you minimize your tax burden on your heirs from inheriting things. And sometimes it can be used to simplify the transfer process, or what's called probate after death. If you have things that you think your family are going to fight about, right? You don't want to have that kind of argument, right? You want people to be able to support each other and not have to, you know, fight about who gets great-grandmother's china.
And since we're talking about animals here, a lot of people have heard of a will, but why is setting up an animal trust recommended over maybe simply mentioning an animal in a will?
We think, well, I'm going to give my money to the dog, but like we just said, they're property, and you can't leave money to a chair, and you can't leave a bank account to your dog. What you could do is, like you asked before, like, well, what if I just have a person who agrees that they'll do it, and I'll name them in the will, and I'll give them money? Well, you could, and the money would go to that person, but we have no guarantee that they'll do what you want them to do. And even if you give them instructions, there's no way to enforce it. You're gone. The dog can't talk. The cat can't talk. And so we don't know what's going to happen. The other reason why that doesn't work very well is that there's this process called probate. When you die, a court takes over and works with whoever was named as the executor to your will, if you had one. And if you didn't have a will, then somebody gets assigned. And they go through this process where they go through all of your documents and all of your assets and all your debts and figure out who gets paid in what order and what you asked to be done, or if you didn't ask to be done. Anyway, it can take months. It can take years to go through that process. Your dog has to be fed tomorrow, and it can't wait 6 months to a year to figure out who's responsible for feeding it.
And so how do pet trusts work? Obviously, you create a trust, but then who are the beneficiaries? Who takes care of everything?
Well, you know, that's what you decide in working with an estate planning attorney. They can go through whatever state you're in to look to see what is required and what, you know, the proper names for things are, et cetera. Essentially, you want to decide who is going to be the caretaker of your money and who's going to be the caretaker of your animals. So you identify the trustee. The trustee is the person who is keeping the money and responsible for dispensing the money. There's the companion animal or pet, the caregiver. And you can also name someone a trust protector or the enforcer. That is, who is going to speak on behalf of the animal, just much like a guardian ad litem is for children in the court system. Like, who's going to speak for that animal's interests if the trustee and the caregiver aren't living up to the promises they made? Now, Virginia's statute actually provides that anyone can be the enforcer, but you can specifically name someone in the trust. So you have to come up with a document that identifies these things, and then you have to figure out whether this is going to go into effect while you're still alive or it's going to go into effect after your death. You have to figure out how you're going to fund it and how much you're going to put in there. You have to think about who are the backups if something happens to your trustee or your caregiver, and you have to think about what happens if there's money left over after your pet lives out its natural lifespan. The other thing you might think about is if there were any special instructions. Like, do you have a strong opinion about what would happen if your pet was sick? Do you have a strong opinion under what circumstances your pet could be euthanized? And you would include those in the trust as well.
There are different types of trusts. What's the difference, and why would somebody choose one over the other when it comes to their companion animals?
A testamentary trust basically comes in after your death. It's testamentary because it comes out of the terms of the will, right? You write a will and you say in your will, you want this trust to be created upon your death, and the money that's in your estate gets set aside to according to whatever your instructions are. An inter vivos trust basically is you're setting up a trust, is a revocable living trust. You're setting it up while you're still living, and you can change your mind and get rid of it, or you can change the terms of it. So for example, you know, maybe your pet dies before you do, or maybe you acquire more pets, right? So you can make some changes, or your circumstances change and you can put more money or less money in there. The downside to that is you have to set it up and fund it now, and then you have to maintain it for the rest of your life so that it's there, and you have to update it when your circumstances or your pets change. The advantage to that, though, then, is that's in place from the moment that you die. It's there for your pets and for the caregiver. Whereas the revocable trust is, you know, is subject to that probate process.
So if someone is interested in setting up an animal trust, I imagine there are going to be certain instructions that they want to include about the animal. What are some things that maybe will come into play about the animal's needs that should be mentioned in such a legal instrument?
One of the really important things is to have a detailed idea of the typical expenses. What's its special food? What's its level of exercise? What do you spend money on? Because you want to be able to justify how much money you're putting into the trust. So for example, the average amounts that people put into a trust are typically around $15,000 to $20,000. The ASPCA has estimates on their website of like what the annual cost for a dog would be based on its size. So you could use some things like that as a guide. There are some, you know, sensational cases in the past that people may have heard of, like Leona Helmsley, where people put millions of dollars, gazillions of dollars into the trust for the care of their pet. And in her case, she bought a house, and her driver, who was the only person that her dog didn't bite, was the one who would live in the house and take care of the dog. The dog got like grooming once a week for thousands of dollars. I think the groomer got paid more than I've ever paid a hairdresser, like in sum total in my life. There was some justification for some of the expense, but not all of it. So what happened in that case was that the will was challenged. Her human children challenged the will. A bunch of people challenged her will. And so one of the results of that was that the judge looked at what projected expenses were, even for the lifestyle to which trouble had become accustomed. Even that didn't justify the gazillions of dollars that were in the trust. So it permitted a certain amount to be taken out of that trust and distributed according to the rest of her estate plans.
You also need to look at the age of the animal, right?
Right. So you're basically being, you know, the actuary for your pet. But yeah, so you're making a best guess at this. You're making a good faith estimate of what it is. You're perhaps putting in some extra for end of life or extraordinary medical situations. In addition to the money question, right, of how much you need to set aside for your pet, there's a pretty long checklist of things that you could consider and talk over with the attorney who's helping you to draft. So how this interplays with your existing estate plan for your human family. You want to provide detailed information about the pets to be included in the trust. As you just mentioned, their expected lifespan, any chronic health issues, or whether there are things, for example, that might be common to the breed that you want to plan for, like hip dysplasia for some large dogs, and the smush-nosed dogs, for example, with their breathing troubles. You might also think about if you have, for example, pet insurance in place that would help your caregiver take care of the animal. And then you might think about, like, again, what's your expected standard of living? Do you have a level of exercise, socialization. Is the pet spayed or neutered? Can they be? Or are they breeding animals? Are there grooming or maintenance routines? And then when you get into horses, there's a whole lot more too as well. And you can think about, like, can the pet be rehomed? What if the caregiver can't continue to care for the pet? What happens if the trust runs out of money? Can people inspect the home? How often? How are they going to verify that the animal's still alive and it's the same animal and not a substitute that looks a lot like the original one?
That sounds like there have been cases about this, right?
There are no reported cases, but there are stories. So it's not uncommon, for example, for some purebred dogs to be tattooed, you know, microchips as well. But microchips get lost.
I was going to say microchips can be easier removed than a tattoo.
Yes, and put on to another dog.
Wow, the things that people do. And you were talking about lifespans. And so I know that some people, they have parrots or tortoises who have very long lifespans and can live beyond the lifespan of their human. So those are some of the cases, I imagine, that you're saying very careful consideration about financial matters. And also physical needs and emotional needs need to be taken care of.
Definitely. And that's why, like, some parrot rescues, or like you said, tortoise rescues, if you contact them and ask that they will agree to take your bird upon your death, they require you to put estate planning in place that gives a bequest to them and provides enough money for the life, potential lifespan. You know, African greys can live to be 75 years.
That's really good to know. I want to go back to caretakers again, because a lot of people, when they're setting up an animal trust, they want to make sure that there's going to be a reliable caretaker for their animals. And you did mention that sometimes you might want to have a second caretaker in place. But what are some of the personal qualities and abilities that people should be looking for in their caretakers?
A willingness would be the first one. It's somebody who's willing to do this. And the other thing too is thinking about, depending on your age, depending on the caretaker's age, as time goes on, you might have to revisit your plan. Is that person still physically able to take care of the pet that you might leave them? And if not, what could be done about that? You know, could part of your planning then include a dog walker or a pet sitter or something like that? And it depends on the type of pet. Many times people look to, if they don't have family, they maybe have the dog walker or the pet sitter who has cared for the animal, or a neighbor who has cared for the animal that's willing to do this. And sometimes if you don't have someone right away, maybe you have someone whose judgment you trust. You can let them choose the caretaker.
So if that option doesn't exist, what about animal rescue sanctuary or lifetime care facilities?
They exist. There aren't a lot, you know, and they may have different requirements. I don't know what their requirements are, the Best Friend Sanctuary that take companion animals, but that's what they try to do, is provide a lifelong place where animals can be that's not like doggy jail, but that it's more residential. And there are, like, the bird rescues that I've mentioned, but they will often require that there be some financial investment ahead of time. The thing you have to be careful of is, do they still exist when you die? So a lot of due diligence to be done there. And then there's contingency plans. So you typically have a backup benefit. You have a backup trustee, a backup caretaker, or you have a backup beneficiary for the residuary for the money that's left over once the pet passes. But sometimes too, you maybe your fallback is you allow the person to choose the next person.
I think that's a very important point. If you're giving them the trust already, then you assume that they have the wherewithal to know what's right for your beloved companion animal, and saying, I'm going to have to trust their judgment when I'm no longer around.
That, and you asked about the qualities. You know, sometimes the qualities of the caretaker are different than the qualities you need for somebody who takes care of your money. And while we expect the best of everybody, being both the trustee of the money and the caretaker of the animal sets up some conflicts of interest that can invite or tempt people into bad behavior.
Right. So you were talking about looking at them as separate individuals there.
Yes. Little checks and balances.
Yeah, exactly. I do want to make sure our listeners are aware of a free resource they can get, a workbook called Secure Your Companion Animal's Future, Crafting a Plan for When You're No Longer Around, which is available at readywhenstuffhappens.com/learn. So if there are other family members in the picture when an animal trust is being created, what are your recommendations about letting them know about the existence of the trust to avoid possibly any disagreements or any problems down the road?
I think it depends on your relationship with them and how your plans impact them. Obviously, if somebody's getting selected to be the caretaker, you want them to know that. You want your family members to know that you have a plan in place so that if they don't have a copy of your will, they don't know about the trust, they don't do something else with the animal before your wishes get put into place. So they need to know about it. And it might also help to, you know, it might relieve some stress for them to know that, oh, I'm not getting that nightmare dog and that bites everybody except the driver, or to know that they're not going to have to work, you know, take care of these expensive horses. That could relieve some stress for them. And if you are concerned, I mean, some of this isn't really legal advice. This is, you know, human advice, is how can you have conversations with them to make sure that they're taken care of and understand that this is, nobody's getting more pie than anybody else. You're taking care of other people. It doesn't reflect any, you know, on them. However, it also could be the opposite, because Leona Helmsley did not like her children, and they did not like her, and she intentionally did not leave them money. So what was important was that she said in her will that she was purposely disinheriting her children. So it wasn't a question of like she forgot, or it was an oversight, or she thought they were going to get something somewhere. She's like, no, I'm doing this on purpose. So that helped any challenge against the will.
You were talking about making sure that there are enough assets in the trust so the animal is taken care of. What happens if the animal passes away and then there are still assets of the trust? What do you do with those, or what are some of the options people have?
When you create that trust, you have to name who the residuary beneficiary is. That is, who's going to get the leftovers. This is important to draft carefully and with thought, because this was, when I said multiple people challenged Leona Helmsley's will, some of the parties were those residuary beneficiaries. The charities that could potentially have gotten the money that was left over from the trust were some of the ones saying, don't let it just sit there. Give it to us now so we can help people now. But one of the other things that happened was that it wasn't drafted carefully as to what kind of charity the money would go to. And so there was fighting about what kind of charity it should be. So if you wanted to specifically go to a charity that helps African gray parrots, either name one, and if that one ceases to exist, say that it's something that forms the same function or has the same charitable purpose as the one that you had named initially.
Let's say somebody has gone about creating an animal trust, but then while they're still alive, they want to change something. Can they do that?
If they've created an inter vivos trust easily, they can. I mean, all of your estate planning, you can change that as long as you're alive and you're competent. You can always modify it, and you know, you can talk with your attorney about the best way to do that.
Where should people keep copies of their animal trust?
The same place they keep their other important documents. You know, if you are going to have things, it used to be that the recommendation was that you have some fireproof safe in your house or a safe deposit box. Everything's online now. So you want to make sure that people can have access to your online documents after you pass. So it would be a good idea to have, you know, some people put together a binder, for example, like you actually do a hard copy thing that says, here's how to get into, here are my bank accounts, here are my passwords, here's the magic word you have to say, because it's very, and like, it's also for social media, it's very difficult to get into those accounts on someone's behalf after they've died.
So the same place is you keep all of your other most important legal documents. And you were saying earlier, make sure family members, for example, know where some of this stuff is located so that if you find yourself incapacitated, you know, in the hospital or who knows what, and somebody needs to access this stuff quickly, they know where to go rather than trying to hunt through your closet or under the floorboards or God knows where else.
Right.
Every state and the District of Columbia has a pet trust law. Are they substantially the same, or are there vast differences between them?
I would say that they are generally the same in the sense that they say that you should, you know, that there should be a trustee, there's a caregiver, you have to identify the animals, and there has to be, it has to be funded. All of these were based on model statutes. So where they tend to differ is how long the trust can be in existence. So some states say that it's the, if there's more than one animal named, it's until the end of the life of the last animal. And some states have a specific number of years, 21 years. So if you're in a state that's got 21 years and you've got an African gray parrot, you're going to have to make some other plans. The other thing that they might vary on is that enforcer role, or the, who has standing to make sure that the trust is being administered the way that you asked it to be done. So some of them may require you to name a person. Some of them may describe the person. And that's one way that they will sometimes vary. You can start with your estate planning attorney and tell them what you want, but you would search with the words pet trust, estate planning attorney. And you can also go to some of the different animal welfare organizations may have recommendations. Mostly they might have advice and recommendations. And the state bar may also maintain a list as well.
The last question is, how can estate planning give people greater peace in mind? Because I imagine that there are folks out there saying, well, you know what, I think it's all going to work out, but I want to. And the reason we're talking today is to encourage people to plan ahead.
There are a couple of different reasons to do this. And we've touched on some of these as we've been talking. But the first one is that if you want to have control over where your possessions go and who they go to, then that's what estate planning is all about. And that might be because you care about who gets the things, or you care about taking care of specific people. But it also may be that, for example, you want to name your fur children or human children's guardians wanted your pet or your child to end up in foster care. You want to make sure that there's a plan in place for them. Some people may be fortunate enough to be worrying about taxes and not having a lot of their money taken away by taxes. And so there are ways to plan to minimize the impact of death taxes on what you leave for your family or your heirs, whoever you choose afterwards. So there's benefits to that, the reducing the taxes. And finally, and we again did talk about this too, is avoiding arguments in the family after you're gone over your things that might happen to be of value to everyone or difficult to divvy up fairly.
Yeah. And just to repeat the point you had made earlier, which was planning ahead so that the animal whom you've loved and spent a lot of time with doesn't inadvertently end up in the shelter where their future is definitely not guaranteed.
Exactly. Nothing more heartbreaking than elder dogs in a shelter.
If people want to learn more about this, how can they get in touch with you?
Well, I teach at the University of Richmond School of Law, law.richmond.edu. It's easiest to go to the faculty website and search on Dobbs.
Ashley, thank you so much for having taken the time today.
Absolutely. Thank you for having me here and giving me a chance to talk about this. It's so important to me that people find out, take an opportunity to care, make a plan for their pets to be cared for afterwards.